Chapter 6. Daycare. When I call my mother to tell her that Bean has been accepted into a daycare center run by the city of Paris, there's a long pause on her end of the line. Daycare? She asks finally. Friends back home are skeptical, too. It's just not a situation I want, sniffs a friend, whose son is 9 months old, about the same age Bean will be when she starts daycare. I want him to have a little more individual attention. But when I tell my French neighbors that Bean has been accepted to the creche, as the full-time daycares are known here, they congratulate me and practically crack open the champagne. It's the sharpest difference between the countries I've seen so far. Middle-class mothers in the United States generally aren't fans of daycare. The very words daycare conjure images of pedophiles and howling babies in dirty, dimly lit rooms. I want him to have a little more individual attention, is a euphemism for, unlike you, I actually love my child and don't want to institutionalize him. American parents who can afford it tend to hire full-time nannies, then start easing their kids into preschool when they're 2 or 3. Those who must send their kids to daycare do so warily and often full of guilt. But middle-class French parents, architects, doctors, fellow journalists, are clawing past one another to get a spot in their neighborhood creche, which is open 5 days a week, usually from 8 to 6. Mothers apply when they're pregnant, then harangue, cajole, and beg. Creches are subsidized by the state, and parents are charged sliding fees based on their incomes.
I felt that it was a perfect system, absolutely perfect, gushes my friend Esther, a French lawyer, whose daughter started at the creche when she was 9 months old. Even friends of mine who don't work try to enroll their kids in the creche. As a distant second choice, they consider part-time daycare or nannies, which are subsidized too. Government websites give all the options. All this gives me a kind of cultural vertigo. Will daycare make my child aggressive, neglected, and insecurely attached, as the scary American headlines say? Or will she be socialized, awakened, and skillfully looked after, as French parents assure me? For the first time, I worry that we're taking our little intercultural experiment too far. It's one thing to start holding a fork in my left hand and giving blank looks to strangers. It's quite another to subject my child to a potentially weird and damaging experience for the bulk of her toddlerhood. Are we going a bit too native? Bean can try foie gras, but should she try the creche? I decide to read up on this daycare with a funny name. Why is it even called a creche? I thought that was the name for a nativity scene. It turns out that the story of the French creche began in the 1840s. Jean-Baptiste Firmin Marbeau, an ambitious young lawyer in search of a cause to champion, was deputy mayor of Paris's first district. It was the middle of the Industrial Revolution, and cities like Paris were teeming with women who'd arrived from the provinces to work as seamstresses and in factories. Marbeau was charged with writing a study of the salles d'asile, free nursery schools for kids aged 2 to 6. He was impressed. "How carefully," I said to myself, "society watches over the children of the poor," he wrote. But Marbeau wondered who looked after poor children between birth and age 2 while their mothers worked. He consulted the district's poor list and set off to visit several mothers. "At the far end of a filthy backyard, I call out for Madame Gerard, a washerwoman. She comes down, not wanting me to enter her home, too dirty to be seen. Those are her words. She holds a newborn baby on her arm and a child of 18 months by the hand." Marbeau discovered that when Madame Gerard went off to wash laundry, she left her children with a babysitter. This cost her 70 centimes a day, about a third of her daily wages. And the babysitter was an equally poor woman who, when Marbeau visited, was at her post, watching over 3 young children on the floor in a shabby room. That wasn't bad child care by the day standards for the poor. Some mothers locked kids alone in apartments, or tied them to bedposts for the day. Slightly older kids were often left to watch their siblings while their mothers worked. Many very young babies still lived at the homes of wet nurses, where conditions could be life-threatening. Marbot was seized with an idea, the creche. The name was meant to invoke the cozy manger in the Christmas story. It would be all-day care for poor children from birth to age two. Funding would come from donations by wealthy patrons, some of whom would also help oversee creches. Marbot envisioned a Spartan but spotless building, where women called nurses looked after babies and counseled mothers on hygiene and morals. Mothers would pay just 50 cents a day. Those with unweaned infants would return twice a day to breastfeed. Marbot's idea struck a chord. There was soon a creche commission to study the matter, and he set off to woo potential donors. Like any good fundraiser, he appealed to both their sense of charity and to their economic self-interest. "These children are your fellow citizens, your brothers. They are poor, unhappy, and weak. You should rescue them," he wrote in a creche manual published in 1845. Then he added, "If you can save the lives of 10,000 children, make haste. 20,000 extra alms a year are not to be disdained. Alms are work, and work creates wealth." The creche was also supposed to give a mother peace of mind, so she could devote herself to her work with an easy conscience. In his manual, Marbot instructs creches to open from 5:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. to cover the typical workday for laborers. The life Marbot describes for mothers isn't too different from that of a lot of working mothers I know today. She gets up before 5 o'clock, dresses her child, does some housework, runs to the creche, runs to work. At 8 o'clock, she hastens back, fetches her child with the day's dirty linen, rushes home to put the poor little creature to bed, and to wash his linen so it will be dry the next day, and every day the whole process is repeated. How on earth does she manage? Evidently, Marbot was quite persuasive. The first creche opened in a donated building on the Rue de Chaillot in Paris. 2 years later, there were 13 creches. The number continued to grow, especially in Paris. After World War II, the French government put creches under the control of the newly formed Mother and Infant Protection Service, PMI, and created an official degree program for the job of péricultrice, a person who specialized in caring for babies and young children. By the beginning of the 1960s, the French poor were less desperate, and there were fewer of them. However, more middle-class mothers were working, so the creche began attracting middle-class families, too. The number of spots nearly doubled in 10 years, reaching 32,000 in 1971. Suddenly, middle-class mothers got sulky if they couldn't get a place in a creche. It was starting to seem like an entitlement for working mothers. All kinds of variants on the creche opened, too. There were part-time daycares, family creches, where parents pitched in, and company creches for employees. Guided by Françoise Dolto's insistence that babies are people too, there was a new interest in childcare that didn't merely keep kids from getting sick or treat them like potential delinquents. Soon, creches were spouting middle-class values like socialization and awakening. I first hear about the creche when I'm pregnant from my friend Dietland. She's a Chicagoan who's lived in Europe since she graduated from college. In Paris, there's a whole cast of semester-abroad expatriates who married their junior-year boyfriends or just never got around to leaving. Dietland is warm, speaks effortless French, and still charmingly refers to herself as a feminist. She's one of the few people I know who's actually striving to make the world a better place. About the only thing wrong with Dietland is that she can't cook. Her family subsists almost entirely on food from Picard, the French frozen food chain. She once tried to serve me defrosted sushi, rice and all. Despite this, Dietland is a model mother, so when she tells me that her two sons, ages 5 and 8, attended the creche around the corner from me, I take note. She says the creche was excellent. Years later, she still stops by to greet the directrice and her son's old teachers. The boys still talk about their creche days with joyful nostalgia. Their favorite caregiver used to give them haircuts. What's more, Dietland offers to put in a good word with the directrice. She keeps repeating to me that the creche isn't fancy. I'm not sure what this means. Does she think that I require Philippe Stark playpens? Is not fancy code for dirty? Though I put up a brave multicultural front for my mother, the truth is that I share some of her doubts. The fact that the creche is run by the city of Paris seems kind of creepy. It feels like I'll be dropping my baby off at the post office, or the Department of Motor Vehicles. I have visions of faceless bureaucrats rushing past Bean's bassinet as she weeps. Maybe I do want fancy, whatever that means. Or maybe I just want to look after Bean myself. Unfortunately, I can't. I'm midway through writing the book that I was supposed to hand in before Bean was born. I took a few months off after her birth, but now my already once extended deadline looms. We've hired a lovely nanny, Adeline, from the Philippines, who shows up in the morning and looks after Bean all day. The problem is, I work from home in a little alcove office. The temptation to micromanage them both, to the irritation of everyone, is irresistible. Bean does seem to be developing a decent passive understanding of Tagalog, the main language of the Philippines, but I suspect that Adeline often ends up speaking Tagalog to her at our local McDonald's, since each time we pass by it, Bean points and shouts. Perhaps a non-fancy creche is a better option. I'm also amazed that, thanks to Dietland, we have an inn somewhere. I'm used to being out of sync with the rest of the country. Sometimes I don't know it's a national holiday until I walk outside and find that all the shops are closed. Having Bean in a creche would connect us more to France. The creche is also tantalizingly convenient. There's one across the street from our house. Dietland's is a 5-minute walk. Like those 19th-century washerwomen, I could pop in to breastfeed Bean and wipe her snot. Mostly, though, it's hard to resist all this French adult peer pressure. I'm glad they're not trying to get me to smoke. Anne and the other French mothers in our courtyard chime in about the wonders of the creche, too. Simon and I figure that even with our inn, our odds of actually getting in are small. So we go to our local town hall and apply for a spot. Why are middle-class Americans so skeptical of daycare? The answer has its roots in the 19th century, too. By the middle of the 1800s, news of Mabot's creches reached America, which had its own horror stories about poor kids being tied to bedposts. Curious philanthropists and social activists traveled to Paris. They were impressed. Over the following decades, charity-financed creches opened in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Buffalo for the children of poor, working mothers. A few used the French name, but most were called day nurseries. By the 1890s, there were 90 American day nurseries. Many cared for the children of recent immigrants. They were supposed to keep these kids off the streets and turn them into Americans. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was a separate nursery school movement in America to create private preschools and kindergartens for children aged around 2 to 6. These grew out of new ideas about the importance of early learning and of stimulating kids' social and emotional development. From the start, they appealed to middle and upper middle class American parents. The separate origins of daycare and preschool explain why, more than 100 years later, daycare still has a working class connotation in America, while middle-class parents battle to get their 2-year-olds into preschool. It also explains why today's American preschools often last just a few hours a day. It's presumed that mothers of the students don't have to work or can afford nannies. One segment of American society that isn't ambivalent about daycare is the U.S. military. The Department of Defense runs America's largest daycare system, with about 800 child development centers, or CDCs, on military installations around the world. The centers accept kids from the age of 6 weeks and are typically open from 6 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. The American military's daycare system looks remarkably like the French creche. Operating hours wrap around the workday. Fees are scaled according to parents' combined income. The government subsidizes about half the cost. And, like the French creche, the military's daycare centers are so popular they usually have long waiting lists. But outside the military, middle-class American parents remain ambivalent about daycare. This is partly an issue of nomenclature. If you call it early childhood education, 0 through 5, they think it's worthwhile, says Sheila Kammerman, a professor at Columbia University who's been tracking daycare for decades. These days, it's often simply called childcare. Americans remain consumed by the question of how even normal daycare affects a child's fragile psyche. There are headlines on whether daycare causes learning delays, makes kids more aggressive, or leaves them insecurely attached to their mothers. I know American moms who quit their jobs rather than subject their kids to daycare. They are often right to worry, since the quality of American daycare is extremely uneven. There are no national regulations. Some states don't require caregivers to have any training. The U.S. Department of Labor says childcare workers earn less than janitors, and that dissatisfaction with benefits, pay, and stressful working conditions cause many to leave the industry. Annual turnover rates of 35% are common. There are some good daycare centers, of course, but these can be extremely expensive or limited to employees of certain companies, and bad centers are amply in evidence, with poor kids getting especially bad care. Other centers, usually the expensive ones, treat babyhood like a college prep course. Perhaps to calm nervous parents, a Colorado-based company boasts that, in its centers, children under the age of 1 are taught literacy. French mothers are convinced that the crèche is good for their kids. In Paris, about a third of kids under the age of 3 go to the crèche, and half are in some kind of collective care. There are still fewer crèches outside Paris. French mothers do worry about pedophiles, but not at the crèche. They think kids are safer in settings with lots of trained adults looking after them, rather than being alone with a stranger. According to a report by a national group that advocates for parents, if she's going to be tête-à-tête with someone, I want it to be me, the mother of an 18-month-old at Bint crèche tells me. The mother says if she hadn't gotten a spot in the crèche, she would have quit her job. French mothers do worry about the anguish they'll feel when they drop their children off at a crèche for the first time, but they view this as their own separation issue. In France, parents are not afraid of sending their children to the crèche, explains Marie Wierink, a sociologist with France's Ministry of Labor. Au contraire, they fear that if they cannot find a place in the crèche, the child will be missing out on something. Kids don't learn to read in a crèche. They don't learn letters or other pre-literacy skills. What they do is socialize with other kids. In America, some parents mention this to me as a benefit of daycare. In France, all parents do. I knew that it was very good. It was an opening to social life, says my friend Esther, the lawyer, whose daughter entered a crèche at 9 months old. French parents take for granted that crèches are of universally high quality and that the members of their staffs are caring and highly skilled. In French parenting chat rooms, the most serious complaint I can find about a crèche is from a mother whose child was served ravioli along with moussaka, a similarly heavy dish. I sent a letter to the crèche, and they responded to me saying their regular chef was not there, she explains. She adds darkly, let's see what happens the rest of the week. This certainty that the crèche is good for kids raises a lot of maternal guilt and doubt. My friend Hélène, an engineer, didn't work during the first few years after her youngest daughter was born. But she was never remotely apologetic about sending the little girl to the crèche 5 days a week. This was in part so that Hélène could have time to herself, but also because she didn't want her daughter to miss out on the communal experience. The main question people in France ask about daycare is how to get more kids into it. Thanks to France's current baby boom, you can't run for public office in France, on the right or the left, without promising to build more crèches or expand existing ones. I read about a program to turn disused baggage areas and train stations into crèches for the children of commuters. Much of the construction cost would go toward soundproofing. Competition for the existing spots in a crèche is, as the French say, énergique. A committee of bureaucrats and creche directors in each of Paris's 20 arrondissements convenes to dole out their available spots. In the well-heeled 16th arrondissement, there are 4,000 applicants for 500 spots. In our less rarefied area in eastern Paris, the odds of getting a spot are 1 in 3. Scrambling for a spot in a creche is one of the initiation rituals of new parenting. In Paris, women can officially begin petitioning the town hall when they're 6 months pregnant. But magazines urge women to schedule a meeting with the director of their preferred creche as soon as they have a positive pregnancy test. Priority goes to single parents, multiple births, adoptees, households with three or more kids, or families with particular difficulties. How to fit into this last ambiguous category is a topic of furious speculation in online forums. One mother advises writing to town hall officials about your urgent need to return to work and your epic but ultimately failed efforts to find any other form of childcare. She suggests copying this letter to the regional governor and the president of France, then requesting a private audience with the district mayor. You go there with the baby in your arms, looking desperate, and you retell the same story as in the letter, she says. I can assure you that this will work. Simon and I decide to work our only angle, being foreign. In a letter attached to our creche application, we extol Bean's budding multilingualism, she doesn't actually speak yet, and describe how her Anglo-Americanism will enrich the creche. As promised, Dietlin talks us up to the director of the creche that her sons went to. I meet with this woman and try to project a mix of desperation and charm. I call the town hall once a month. For some reason, as with French couples, most of the creche courting falls to me, to remind them of our enormous interest and need for a spot. Since I'm not French and can't vote here, I decide not to bother the president. Amazingly, these attempts to massage the process actually work. A congratulatory letter arrives from our town hall, explaining that Bean has been assigned a spot in a creche for mid-September, when she'll be 9 months old. I call Simon triumphant. We foreigners have beaten the natives at their own game. We're amazed and giddy from the victory. But we also have the feeling that we won a prize that we don't quite deserve and aren't even sure we want. I still have my doubts when we take Bean to her first day of creche. It's at the end of a dead-end street, in a three-story concrete building with a little astroturf courtyard out front. It looks like a public school in America, but with everything in miniature. I recognize some of the kids' furniture from the IKEA catalog. It's not fancy, but it's cheerful and clean. The kids are divided by age into sections called small, medium, and large. Bean's class is in a sunlit room with play kitchens, tiny furniture, and cubbyholes full of age-appropriate toys. Attached to the room is a glassed-in sleeping area where each child has his own crib, stocked with his pacifier, and stuffed animal companion, called a doudou. Anne-Marie, who'll be Bean's main caregiver, greets us. She's the same lady who gave haircuts to Dietlin's sons. Anne-Marie is a grandmother in her 60s, with short blonde hair and a rotating collection of printed T-shirts from places her charges have traveled to. We'll eventually bring her one attesting to her love of Brooklyn. Employees have worked at the creche for an average of 13 years. Anne-Marie has been there much longer. She and most of the other caregivers are trained as auxiliaires de périculture, which has no exact American equivalent. A pediatrician and a psychologist each visit the creche once a week. The caregivers chart Bean's daily naps and poops and report to me about how she's eaten. They feed the kids Bean's age one at a time, with the child either on someone's lap or in a bouncy seat. They put the kids down to sleep at roughly the same time each day and claim not to wake them up. For this initial adaptation period, Anne-Marie asks me to bring in a shirt that I've worn so that Bean can sleep with it. This feels a bit canine, but I do it. I'm struck by the confidence that Anne-Marie and the other caregivers have. They're quite certain about what children of each age need, and they're equally confident in their abilities to provide this. They convey this without being smug or impatient. My one gripe is that Anne-Marie insists on calling me Mother Aubine rather than Pamela. She says it's too difficult to learn the names of all the parents. Given our doubts about daycare, we've compromised by enrolling Bean just 4 days a week, from about 9:30 to 3:30. Plenty of her classmates will be there 5 days a week for much longer each day. The creche is open from 7:30 to 6. As in Marbot's day, Bean is supposed to arrive with a clean diaper. This becomes an almost Talmudic point of discussion between Simon and me. What constitutes arrival? If Bean poops on her way in the door, or while we're saying goodbye, who changes the offending diaper? Is it us or the auxiliaires? The first 2 weeks are an adaptation period, in which she stays for increasingly long periods at the creche, with and without us. She cries a bit each time I leave, but Anne-Marie assures me that she quiets down soon after I go. Often one of the caregivers holds her up at the window facing the street so I can wave when I get outside. If the creche is damaging Bean, we can't tell. Pretty soon she's cheerful when we drop her off and happy when we pick her up. Once Bean has been at the creche for a while, I begin to notice that the place is a microcosm of French parenting. That includes the bad stuff. Anne-Marie and the other caregivers are mystified that I'm still nursing Bean when she's 9 months old, and especially when I nurse her on the premises. They're not thrilled with my short-lived plan to drop off pumped breast milk before lunch each day, though they don't try to stop me. But all the big positive French parenting ideas are in evidence, too. Since there's so much agreement anyway on the best way to do things, French parents don't have to worry that the caregivers aren't following their personal parenting philosophy. For the most part, the caregivers reinforce the same schedule and habits as parents. For example, the caregivers talk to even very young children all the time at the creche, with what seems like perfect conviction that the children understand. And there's a lot of talk about the cadre. At a parents' meeting, one of the teachers speaks almost poetically about it. Everything is very encadre, built into a framework, the hour that they arrive and leave, for example. But inside this framework, we try to introduce flexibility, fluidity, and spontaneity for the children and also for the teaching team. Bean spends a lot of the day just ambling around the room, playing with whatever she wants. I'm concerned about this. Where are the music circles and organized activities? I soon realize that all this freedom is by design. It's the French cadre model yet again. Kids get firm boundaries, but lots of freedom within those boundaries. And they're supposed to learn to cope with boredom and to play by themselves. When the child plays, he constructs himself, Sylvie, another of Bean's caregivers, tells me. A mayor's report on Parisian creches calls for a spirit of energetic discovery, in which the children are left to exercise their appetite for experimentation of their five senses, of using their muscles, of sensations, and of physical space. As kids get older, they do have some organized activities, but no one is obliged to participate. We propose, we don't force, another of Bean's teachers explains. There's soothing background music to launch the kids into their naps and a pile of books that they can read in bed. The kids gradually wake up to their goûter, the afternoon snack. The creche isn't the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's more like Canyon Ranch. In the playground, there are a few rules, also by design. The idea is to give kids as much freedom as possible. When they're outside, we intervene very little, says Marie, another one of Bean's caregivers. If we intervene all the time, they go a little nuts. The creche also teaches kids patience. I watch as a 2-year-old demands that Marie pick her up, but Marie is cleaning up the table where the children have just had lunch. For the moment, I'm not free. You wait 2 seconds, Marie says gently to the little girl. Then she turns to me and explains. We try to teach them to wait. It's very important. They can't have everything right away. The caregivers speak calmly and respectfully to the kids, using the language of rights. You have the right to do this. You don't have the right to do that. They say this with that same utter conviction that I've heard in the voices of French parents. Everyone believes that for the cadre to seem immutable, it has to be consistent.
The prohibitions are always consistent, and we always give a reason for them, Sylvie tells me.
I know the Cleche is strict about certain things because, after a while, Bean repeats phrases she's learned. We know they're Cleche phrases because the teachers there are her only source of French. It's like she's been wearing a wire all day, and now we get to listen to the tape. Most of what Bean repeats is in the command form, like, on va pas crier, we're not going to scream. My rhyming favorites, which I immediately begin using at home, are couche-toi, go to sleep, and mouche-toi, blow your nose, said when you're holding a tissue up to a child's face. For a while, Bean speaks French only in the command form or in these declarations of what's permissible and what isn't. When she plays teacher at home, she stands on a chair, wags her finger, and shouts instructions to imaginary children or, occasionally, to our surprised lunch guests. Soon, in addition to commands, Bean is coming home with songs. She often sings one that we know only as Tomola, Tomola, Vatovi, in which she sings more and more loudly with each line while making a spinning motion with her arms. It's only later that I learn this is one of the most popular French children's songs, which actually goes Ton moulin va trop vite, about a windmill that's going too fast. What really wins us over about the Cleche is the food, or more specifically, the dining experience. Each Monday, the Cleche posts its menu for the week on a giant white board near the entrance. I sometimes photograph these menus and email them to my mother. They read like the chalkboard menus at Parisian brasseries. Lunch is served in four courses, a cold vegetable starter, a main dish with a side of grains or cooked vegetables, a different cheese each day, and a dessert of fresh fruit or fruit puree. There's a slightly modified version for each age group. The youngest kids mostly have the same foods, but pureed. A typical menu starts with hearts of palm and tomato salad. This is followed by sliced turkey au basilic, accompanied by rice in a Provençal cream sauce. The third course is a slice of Saint-Nectaire cheese with a slice of fresh baguette. Dessert is fresh kiwi. An in-house cook at each Cleche prepares lunch from scratch each day. A truck arrives several times a week with seasonal fresh, sometimes even organic, ingredients. Aside from the occasional can of tomato paste, nothing is processed or pre-cooked. A few vegetables are frozen, but never pre-cooked. I have trouble imagining 2-year-olds sitting through a meal like this, so the Cleche lets me sit in on lunch one Wednesday when Bean is home with a babysitter. I'm stunned when I realize how my daughter eats lunch most days. I sit quietly with my reporter's notebook while her classmates assemble in groups of four at square, toddler-sized tables. One of her teachers wheels up a cart filled with covered serving plates and bread wrapped in plastic to keep it fresh. There's a teacher at each table. First, the teacher uncovers and displays each dish. The starter is a bright red tomato salad in vinaigrette. "This is followed by le poisson," she says to approving glances, as she displays a flaky white fish in a light butter sauce and a side dish of peas, carrots, and onions. Next, she previews the cheese course. "Today, it's le bleu," she says, showing the kids a crumbly blue cheese. Then she shows them dessert, whole apples, which she'll slice at the table. The food looks simple, fresh, and appetizing, except for the melamine plates, the bite-sized pieces, and the fact that some of the diners have to be prodded to say, "Merci," I might be in a high-end restaurant. Just who are the people taking care of Bean? To find out, I show up one windy fall morning at the annual entrance examination for ABC, Périculture, one of the schools that train Cleche workers. There are hundreds of nervous women, and a few men in their 20s, who are looking shyly at one another or doing last-minute practice questions in thick workbooks. They're understandably anxious. Of the more than 500 people who sit for this test, just 30 will be admitted to the training school. Applicants are grilled on reasoning, reading comprehension, math, and human biology. Those who advance to the second round face a psychological exam, an oral presentation, and interrogation by a panel of experts. The 30 winners then do a year of coursework and internships, following a curriculum set by the government. They learn the basics of child nutrition, sleep, and hygiene, and practice mixing baby formula and changing diapers. They'll do additional week-long trainings throughout their careers. In France, working in daycare is a career. There are schools all over the country with similarly rigorous entrance standards, creating an army of skilled workers to staff the creches. Just half of caregivers at a creche must be auxiliaire or have a similar degree. A quarter must have degrees related to health, leisure, or social work. A quarter are exempt from any qualifications but must be trained in-house. At Bean's creche, 13 of the 16 caregivers are auxiliaires or similar. I start to see Anne-Marie and other caregivers at Bean's creche as the Rhodes Scholars of baby care. And I understand their confidence. They've mastered a field and earned the respect of parents, and I'm indebted to them. During nearly 3 years that Bean is at the creche, they potty train her, teach her table manners, and give her a French immersion course. By Bean's third year at the creche, I suspect that the days are starting to feel long and that perhaps she's not being stimulated enough. I'm ready for her to move on to preschool. But Bean still seems to like the creche. She chatters all the time about Mackie and Lila, her two best friends. Interestingly, she's gravitated to other children of foreigners. Lila's parents are Moroccan and Japanese. Mackie's dad is from Senegal. She has definitely been socialized. When Simon and I take Bean to Barcelona for a long weekend, she keeps asking where the other children are. The kids in Bean's section spend a lot of time running around and shouting in the AstroTurf courtyard, which is stocked with little scooters and carts. Bean is usually out there when I pick her up. As soon as she spots me, she bolts over and bursts happily into my arms, shouting the news of the day. On Bean's last day at the creche, after the goodbye party and the clearing out of her locker, Bean gives a big hug and kiss goodbye to Sylvie, who's been her main caregiver. Sylvie has been the model of professionalism all year, but when Bean embraces her, Sylvie begins to cry. I cry too. By the end of creche, Simon and I feel that Bean has had a good experience, but we did often feel guilty dropping her off each day, and we can't help but notice the drip of alarming headlines in the American press about how daycare affects kids. Continental Europeans aren't really asking about that anymore. Sheila Kammerman at Columbia says that Europeans pretty much take for granted that high-quality daycare, with small groups and warm, well-trained caregivers who have made the job a career, are good for kids. And conversely, they assume that bad daycare is bad for kids. Americans have too many misgivings about daycare to take this for granted. So the U.S. government has funded the largest ever study of how early childcare arrangements correlate with the way kids develop and behave later in life. Many of the headlines on daycare in America come out of data from this giant study. One of its principal findings is that early childcare arrangements just aren't very significant. Parenting quality is a much more important predictor of child development than type, quantity, or quality of childcare, explains a backgrounder. Children fared better when their parents were more educated and wealthier, when they had books and play materials at home, and when they had enhancing experiences, like going to the library. This was the same whether the child went to daycare for 30 or more hours a week or had a stay-at-home mother. And as I mentioned earlier, the study found that what's especially crucial is a mother's sensitivity, how attuned she is to her child's experience of the world. This is also true at daycare. One of the study's researchers writes that kids get high-quality daycare when the caregiver is attentive to the child's needs, responsive to her verbal and nonverbal signals and cues, stimulating of his curiosity and desire to learn about the world, and emotionally warm, supportive, and caring. Kids fared better with a caregiver who was sensitive, whether it was a nanny, a grandparent, or a daycare worker. It would not be possible to go into a classroom and, with no additional information, pick out which children had been in center care, the researcher writes. I realize that what we Americans should be fretting about isn't just whether bad daycare has bad outcomes, of course it does, but how unpleasant it is for kids to be in bad daycare. We're so concerned about cognitive development that we're forgetting to ask whether children in daycare are happy and whether it's a positive experience for them while it's happening. That's what French parents are talking about. Even my mother gets used to the creche. She starts calling it the creche instead of daycare, which probably helps. The creche certainly has benefits for us. We feel more like we're part of France, or at least part of our neighborhood. Thankfully, we put our ongoing to stay or not to stay in Paris conversation on pause. We can't really imagine moving someplace where we'd struggle to find decent, affordable childcare, and we can see the next excuse for staying in France coming down the pike. The École maternelle, free public preschool, with spots for just about everyone. Mostly, we like the French creche because Bean likes it. She eats blue cheese, shares her toys, and plays tomate ketchup, a French version of duck, duck, goose. Also, she has mastered the command form of French. She is a bit too aggressive. She likes to kick me in the shins, but I suspect that her anger comes from her father anyway. I don't think I can blame daycare for any of her faults. Mackie and Leela are still Bean's dear friends. Occasionally, we even take Bean back to the creche to stare through the gates at the children who are now playing in the courtyard. And every once in a while, out of nowhere, Bean turns to me and says, "Sylvie cried." This was a place where she mattered. Chapter 7. Bébé au lait. Warming up to the creche turned out to be easy. Warming up to the other mothers there wasn't. I'm aware that American-style instant bonding between women doesn't happen in France. I've heard that female friendships here start out slowly and can take years to ramp up. Though once you're finally in with a French woman, you're supposedly stuck with her for life. American insta-friends can drop you any time. I have managed to befriend a few French women in the time I've now lived in Paris, but most either don't have kids or live across town. I just assumed that I'd also meet some other moms in my neighborhood with kids, the same age as Bean. In my fantasy, we'd swap recipes, organize picnics, and complain about our husbands. That's how it happens in America. My own mother is still close with women she met in the playground when I was small. So I'm unprepared when the French mothers at the creche, who all live in my neighborhood and have age-appropriate kids, are practically indifferent to me. They barely say bonjour when we plop our toddlers down next to one another in the morning. I eventually learn the names of most of the kids in Bean's classes, but even after a year or so, I don't think any of the mothers know Bean's name. They certainly don't know mine. This initial stage, if that's what it is, doesn't feel like a ramp up to friendship. Mothers I see several days a week at the creche seem not to recognize me when we pass each other in the supermarket. Perhaps, as the cross-cultural books claim, they're giving me privacy. To speak would be to forge a relationship and thus create obligations, or perhaps are just stuck up. It's the same at the playground. The Canadian and Australian mothers I occasionally meet there treat the playground like I do, as a place to mingle and perhaps make friends for life. Within minutes of spotting one another, we've each revealed our hometown, marital status, and views on bilingual schooling. Soon, we're mirroring like nobody's business. "You trekked to Concord to buy grape nut cereal? Me too!" But usually it's just me and the French mothers, and they don't do me toos. In fact, they barely exchange glances with me, even when our kids are sparring over sandbox toys. When I try icebreakers like, "How old is he?" they usually mutter a number, then eye me like I'm a stalker. They rarely ask any questions back. When they do, they turn out to be Italian. Granted, I'm in the middle of Paris, surely one of the world's least friendly places. The sneer was probably invented here. Even people from the rest of France tell me that they find Parisians cold and distant. I should probably just ignore these women. But I can't help it. They intrigue me. For starters, many of them look so much better than we Americans do. I dropped Bean off at the creche in the morning wearing a ponytail and whatever was on the floor next to my bed. They arrive, fully coiffed and perfumed. I don't even gawk anymore when French mothers prance into the park dressed in high-heeled boots and skinny jeans while pushing strollers with tiny newborns in them. Moms do get a bit fatter as you get farther from central Paris. These mothers aren't just chic, they're also strangely collected. They don't shout the names of their children across the park or rush out with a howling toddler. They have good posture. They don't radiate that famous combination of fatigue, worry, and on-the-vergeness that's bursting out of most American moms I know, myself included. Except for the actual child, you wouldn't know that they're mothers. Part of me just wants to force-feed these women some spoonfuls of fatty pâté. But another part of me is dying to know their secrets. Having kids who sleep well, wait, and don't whine surely helps them stay so calm. But there must be more to it. Are they secretly struggling with anything? Where's their belly fat? Are French mothers really perfect? And if so, are they happy? After the baby is born, the first obvious difference between French and American moms is breastfeeding. For us Anglophone mothers, the length of time that we breastfeed, like the size of a Wall Street bonus, is a measure of performance. One former businesswoman in my Anglophone playgroup regularly sidles up to me and asks, faux innocently, "Oh, are you still nursing?" It's faux, because we all know that our breastfeeding number is a concrete way to compete with one another. A mother's score is reduced if she mixes in formula, relies too heavily on a breast milk pump, or actually breastfeeds for too long, at which point she starts to seem like a crazed hippie. In middle-class circles in the United States, many mothers treat infant formula as practically a form of child abuse. The fact that breastfeeding requires endurance, inconvenience, and in some cases, physical suffering only increases its status. You get bonus points from American moms for nursing in France, where breastfeeding isn't encouraged, and many people find the sight of it disturbing. The breastfeeding mother is regarded, if not as an interesting oddity, then as someone who is performing above and beyond the call of duty, explains the parenting guide, published by Message, the Organization for Anglophone Mothers in Paris. We expatriates exchange horror stories about French doctors who, when confronted with the occasional cracked nipple or blocked duct, blithely tell mothers to switch to formula. To combat this, Message has its own army of volunteer breastfeeding supporters. Before I delivered Bean, one of them warned me never to hand my baby over to the hospital staff while I slept, lest they defy my instructions and give her a bottle when she cried. This woman made nipple confusion sounds scarier than autism. All this adversity makes Anglophone mothers in Paris feel like lactating superheroes, battling the evil doctors and strangers who like to steal antibodies from our babies. In chat rooms, expatriate mothers list the strangest places they've nursed in Paris. Inside Sacré-Cœur Cathedral, on a tomb at Père Lachaise Cemetery, and at a cocktail party at the Four Seasons Hotel Georges V. One mother says she breastfed her baby while standing and complaining at the EasyJet counter in Charles de Gaulle Airport. I sort of laid him on the counter. I pity the poor clerk. Given our zeal, we can't fathom why French mothers barely breastfeed. About 63% of French mothers do some breastfeeding. A bit more than half are still nursing when they leave the maternity hospital, and most abandon it altogether soon after that. Long-term nursing is extremely rare. In the United States, 74% of mothers do at least some breastfeeding, and a third are still nursing exclusively at 4 months. It's harder still for us Anglophones to understand why even a certain type of middle-class French mother, the ones who steam and puree organic leeks for their 7-month-olds and send their 3-year-olds to the same African drumming classes that we do, don't breastfeed much either. "Don't they have the same medical information we have?" one incredulous American mother asks me. Among Anglophone mothers, The reigning theories about why French women don't nurse include: they can't be bothered. They care more about their boobs than about their babies, though apparently it's pregnancy, not breastfeeding, that stretches out breasts. And they just don't know how important it is. Locals tell me that breastfeeding still has a peasant image, from the days when babies were farmed out to rural wet nurses. Others say that artificial milk companies pay off hospitals, give away free samples in maternity wards, and advertise mercilessly. Olivier, who's married to my journalist friend Christine, theorizes that nursing demystifies the female breast, turning it into something utilitarian and animalistic. Just as French fathers strategically avoid a woman's business end during the birth, they avoid viewing the female breast when it's used for unsexy purposes. There are small pockets of breastfeeding enthusiasts in France, but mostly there's little peer pressure to nurse for a long time. When my British friend Allison, who teaches English in Paris, told her doctor that she was still nursing her 13-month-old, she says the doctor asked, "What does your husband say? And your shrink?" Enfant Magazin, one of the main French glossies, says that breastfeeding after 3 months is always viewed badly by one's entourage. Alexandra, the mother of two girls who works in a creche, tells me that she didn't give a drop of breast milk to either of her daughters. She says this without apology or guilt. She says she was thrilled that her husband, who's a fireman, wanted to help care for the girls, and that bottle feeding them was a great way for him to pitch in. She points out that both girls are now perfectly healthy. Alexandra adds, "It was good practice for the father to give a bottle at night, and I could sleep and drink wine in restaurants. It wasn't so bad for maman." Pierre Bitun, a French pediatrician and longtime proponent of breastfeeding in France, says many French women think they just don't have enough milk. Dr. Bitun says this is because French maternity hospitals often don't encourage mothers to feed their newborns every few hours. That's critical in the first few days, so that mothers produce enough milk to feed their babies. If they don't nurse very frequently from the start, then they really don't have enough milk, and a recourse to formula starts to seem inevitable. "By day three, the kid has lost 200 grams, and they say, 'Oh, you don't have enough milk. Let's give him some formula. The kid is starving.' That's what happens. It's crazy." Dr. Bitun speaks often at French hospitals to explain the science and the benefits of breastfeeding, but "the culture is stronger than the science," he says. "3/4 of the people I work with in hospitals don't believe that breast milk is healthier than formula. They think there's no difference. They think artificial milk is fine, or at least that's what they say to mothers, to avoid making them feel guilty." In fact, even though French children consume enormous amounts of formula, they beat American kids on nearly all measures of health. France ranks about 6 points above the developed country average in UNICEF's overall health and safety ranking, which includes infant mortality, immunization rates until age 2, and deaths from accidents and injury up to age 19. The United States ranks about 18 points below the average. French parents see no reason to believe that artificial milk is terrible or to treat breastfeeding as a holy rite. They assume that breast milk is far more critical for a baby born to a poor mother in sub-Saharan Africa than it is for one born to middle-class Parisians. "We look around and see that all the babies who drink formula are fine," says Christine, the journalist, who has two young kids. "We all drink formula, too." I'm not so calm about it. In fact, I'm so panicked by my conversation with a breastfeeding consultant that when I'm in the maternity hospital after Bean is born, I insist that she stay in the room with me around the clock. I wake up each time she whimpers and barely get any rest. This suffering and self-sacrifice just seems like the natural order to me. But after a few days, I realize I'm probably the only mother in the maternity ward who's subjecting herself to this torture. The others, even the ones who are breastfeeding, hand their babies over to the nursery down the hall at night. They feel entitled to a few hours' sleep. I finally feel shattered enough to give this a try, too, even though it feels enormously indulgent. I'm immediately won over by the system, and Bean doesn't seem any worse for it, Contrary to the rumors, the nurses and puéricultrices who work in the nursery are more than happy to wheel her to my room whenever she needs to nurse, and then take her away again. France is probably never going to be ground zero for breastfeeding, but it does have the Protection Maternelle et Infantile, Mother and Infant Protection Service, the same agency that oversees the crèche. This government health service has offices all over Paris that give free checkups and injections to all children until age 6, even those who are in France illegally. Middle-class parents rarely use the PMI because the government insurance plan covers much of the cost of their visits to private pediatricians. The French government is the main insurer, but most French doctors are in private practice. I'm reluctant to use a public clinic. Will it be impersonal? Will it be clean? One crucial fact convinces me. It will be completely free. Our local PMI office is a 10-minute walk from our house. It turns out that we can see the same doctor each time we go. There's a giant indoor playground in the immaculate waiting area. The PMI will send a puéricultrice to your house to check in on you and your baby when you get back from the hospital. If you get the baby blues, they've got an in-house shrink. All of this is free, too. There's not even a bill. It's worth weighing that against an ounce of breast milk. I'm not taking any chances about breastfeeding. The American Academy of Pediatrics says I should nurse for 12 months, so I do, practically to the day. I give Bean a final valedictory feed on her first birthday. Sometimes I do enjoy nursing, but often I find it irritating to interrupt whatever I'm doing to rush back home for feeds or, increasingly, for a date with my electric breast pump. Mostly I forge on because of everything I've read about the health benefits and because I want to stick it to that lady in my playgroup. All the American peer pressure to breastfeed does serve a public health purpose. It gets breast milk into our babies' mouths, but it also makes us a little crazy. French women can see that steamroller of anxiety and guilt coming from a few kilometers away, and they're at least trying to resist it. Dr. Batoun says that in his years of campaigning for breastfeeding, he's found that French mothers generally aren't won over by the health arguments involving IQ points and secretory IgA. What does persuade them to nurse, he says, is the claim that both they and the baby will enjoy it.
We know that the pleasure argument is the only thing that works, he says.
Many French mothers would surely like to breastfeed longer than they do, but they don't want to do it under moral duress or flaunt it at 2-year-olds' birthdays. Powdered milk may be worse for babies, but it no doubt makes the early months of motherhood a lot more relaxing for French moms. French mothers may be relaxed about not breastfeeding, but they aren't relaxed about getting back in shape after they give birth. I'm shocked when I find out that the skinny waitress at the cafe where I go to write most days has a 6-year-old. I had taken her for a 23-year-old hipster. When I tell her about the expression, MILF, Mom, I'd like to fuck, she thinks it's hilarious. There's no French language equivalent. In France, there's no a priori reason why a woman wouldn't be sexy just because she happens to have children. It's not uncommon to hear a Frenchman say that being a mother gives a woman an appealing air of plenitude, happiness, and fullness of spirit. Of course, some American moms quickly shed their baby weight, too, but it's easy to find role models urging women in the other direction. A new mom makeover fashion spread in American Baby magazine shows 3 embarrassed, still slightly chubby women smiling uncomfortably in loose-fitting dresses. They've strategically positioned their toddlers in front of their hips. The text is unapologetic. Giving birth changes your body, and becoming a mom changes your life, it says, before singing the praises of drawstring pants. For some American moms, there's something morally righteous about committing to motherhood at the expense of their bodies. It's like giving yourself over to a higher cause. A sports marketing consultant from Connecticut who has a 6-month-old tells me that a French woman showed up at our local playgroup recently and immediately asked the group, in what I imagine to be a charming Gallic accent, "Okay, so how is everyone losing the weight?" According to the consultant, she and the other American mothers fell silent. This wasn't something they usually discussed. Sure, they would have loved to snap their fingers and knock off 20 pounds, but none of them were losing much weight. It seemed selfish to take time away from their babies to tend to their fat, or even to talk too much about it. You won't silence any rooms in Paris by asking how new mothers lose their baby weight. Just as there's enormous social pressure for women not to gain too much weight while they're pregnant, there's similar pressure to shed the weight soon after they give birth. The sister of the sports marketing consultant is my American friend Nancy, who lives in Paris and has a son with her French boyfriend. The two sisters, who even look alike, are a kind of social experiment. Just by virtue of where they live and who their partners are, they're facing opposite social pressures. Nancy, the sister in Paris, tells me that a few months after she gave birth, her French boyfriend began needling her to stop wearing sweatpants and to shed her spare tire. As an incentive, he offered to take her shopping for new clothes. Nancy says she was both surprised and offended. Like her sister in Connecticut, she had imagined herself to be in a protected mom zone, where she got a pass on her appearance for a while so she could devote herself to looking after the baby. But Nancy's French boyfriend was working from a different script. He still viewed her fully as a woman and felt entitled to the aesthetic benefits that go with that. He was equally surprised and bothered that she was willing to just give that up. In France, 3 months seems to be the magic number. French women of all ages keep telling me they got back their ligne, figure, by 3 months postpartum. Audrey, a French journalist, tells me over coffee that she got her figure back right away after both of her pregnancies, one of which was with twins. "Of course, it was natural," she says. "You too, no?" I was already sitting down when she arrived at the café. As a foreigner who's not married to a Frenchman, I've excused myself from the 3-month rule. I'm not sure I even heard about it until Bean was 6 months old. My body has charmingly decided to store its extra bulk around my belly and hips, giving the impression that I might be holding on to at least the placenta. I'd surely be skinnier if I had French in-laws to needle me. It seems that just as obesity spreads through social networks, so does thinness. If everyone around you assumes that they're going to drop the extra pounds, you are more likely to actually do it. It's also easier to lose weight if you haven't gained too much. To lose their baby weight, French women seem to do a slightly more intensified version of what they do the rest of the time. "I pay a lot of attention," is how my friend Virginie, a svelte mother of three, explains it to me over lunch one day, as I gorge on a giant bowl of Cambodian noodle soup. Any country that France has occupied or colonized is overrepresented in cheap, delicious ethnic restaurants in Paris. Virginie says she never goes on a diet, known in French as a régime. She just pays a lot of attention, some of the time. "What do you mean?" I ask Virginie between slurps. "No bread," she says firmly. "No bread?" I repeat, incredulous. "No bread," Virginie says, with steely, calm conviction. Virginie doesn't mean no bread ever. She means no bread during the week, from Monday to Friday, on the weekends, and on the occasional night out during the week. She says she eats whatever she wants. "You mean whatever you want in moderation, right?" I ask. "No, I eat whatever I want," she says with that conviction again. This is similar to what Mireille Giuliano prescribes in French Women Don't Get Fat. Giuliano suggests taking just one day off, and even then not overdoing it too much. It's inspiring to see someone who's actually implementing this, evidently with great success. Paying attention may be another example of French women intuitively following the best science. Researchers have found that the best way to lose weight and keep it off is to carefully monitor yourself. For instance, by keeping a food diary and weighing yourself daily. They've also discovered that people have more willpower when they don't rule out ever eating certain foods, but rather tell themselves that they will eat those foods later, such as, presumably, during the weekend. I also like the neutral, pragmatic French formulation, paying attention, over the value-laden American one, being good, and its guilt-ridden, demoralizing opposites, cheating and being bad. If you've merely stopped paying attention and had some cake, it seems easier to forgive yourself and to eat mindfully again at the next meal. Virginie says this way of eating is an open secret among women in Paris. Everyone you see who is thin, she draws a kind of imaginary line down her small frame, pays very close attention. When Virginie feels like she's put on a few pounds, she pays closer attention still. My friend Christine, the French journalist, later sums up this system very succinctly for me. Women in Paris don't eat very much. Over lunch, Virginie looks me up and down and evidently decides that I have not been paying attention. You drink café crème, don't you? She says. Café crème is what Parisians call café au lait. It's a cup of steaming milk poured onto a shot of espresso. Without the foam, that would make it a cappuccino. Yes, but I use fat-free milk, I say weakly. I do this when I'm at home. Virginie says that even fat-free milk is hard to digest. She drinks café allongé, lengthened coffee, which is espresso diluted with boiling water. Filtered American coffee or tea is fine, too. I scribble down Virginie's suggestions, drink more water, climb the stairs, go for walks, as if I'm receiving revelation. I'm not obese, like my friend Nancy. I'm just sort of motherly. There's no risk of beans getting jabbed by a hip bone when I bounce her on my lap. I have skinny aspirations, though. I've promised myself that I won't think of getting pregnant again until I finish my book and reach my target number of kilograms. After years in France, I still don't know whether to wear a sweater when I hear the temperature in Celsius, or how tall someone is when they give their height in centimeters, but I immediately know whether my weight in kilograms means I'll fit into my jeans or not.